Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's that time again. Thank you for coming this week to listen to the Council of Trent podcast. My name is Trent Horn, apologist and speaker here at Catholic Answers. And today I'm going to be answering questions that people submitted anonymously to me online about Catholic sexuality, and in particular, what's okay and what's not okay. Because a lot of people have these questions, but they're too embarrassed to ask them, or they don't know who to go to get answers. And they're really important questions that touch on important, intimate aspects of people's lives. So in this episode, we're going to cover some of these questions that were submitted anonymously through Facebook and Twitter. I offered a link for people to fill out a form. Didn't have to give their name or email, but just send me questions you're dealing with, because when I've reviewed them, guess what? Lots of other people are dealing with them too. And so we're going to answer those questions today. So I do want to add a disclaimer. I'm going to be talking about lots of different issues related to sexuality. I'm going to be frank. I'm going to be honest. And because I want people to have the answers so they can lead holy, happy, healthy marital lives, as well as holy, happy, healthy single lives, because some of these questions focus on sexuality related to single people. So I'm just going to be frank and honest. So I'm going to talk about things that are difficult subjects to discuss and mature subjects related to sexuality. So if these are issues you struggle with even hearing about them and thinking about them, they become a stumbling block to you, an opportunity for sin, maybe this is a podcast that an episode you might want to skip. So this is a mature subject matter. I definitely recommend that the audience for this is 18 and over, and what I will be discussing, this is not something for minors to be listening to. This is some people who are adults who are not married, I think, would find this helpful for pastoral concerns, but this is an 18 and over mature subject matter. If you struggle with these issues, even hearing about them, this may be an episode you just want to forego for this time. But if you want to hear about this, to get these answers, they're very important, so I'm going to handle them in a serious, frank, and honest way. Also, I wasn't able to answer all the questions in this episode, so if you anonymously submitted a question and I didn't get to it, go to TrentHornPodcast.com, and I'll put the extra questions there as a bonus episode. That's at TrentHornPodcast.com. With that said, let's go to the questions that were submitted. Number one, isn't anything done between a married couple okay sexually? What would make it wrong? And I purposely picked this as the first question to discuss because this really hits at the foundation of what we need to talk about. Some people have this mistaken idea that sex is just bad before marriage, that anything sexual is bad before marriage, and then after marriage, doesn't matter what you do. The key is just getting married, as if that marriage license is some kind of certificate, a diploma, a professional license to give you permission to do whatever you want sexually. But that's not how it works. In order to understand Catholic sexual ethics, we have to understand this. What is sex for? Sex is for the expression of marital love. Sex is not just something we do. Sex is something we are. We are all sexual beings because we're created in the image and likeness of God, male and female. So even if we don't end up being married, if we choose, you know, a vocation to the priesthood, religious life, or remain single, we are still sexual beings. We have a sexuality. That is not a bad thing. It can only be used in a bad way. And the church teaches that sex definitely is a good thing. Paragraph 2362 of the Catechism says that the acts in marriage in which the intimate and chaste union of the spouses takes place are noble and honorable. Sexuality is a source of joy and pleasure. Back in the 90s, the Pontifical Council for the Family released a wonderful document on how to educate children about sexuality, children and young people, and it's called The Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality. And it says that when you're teaching children, especially, you know, teaching children who are entering into puberty about sexuality, it says parents should not, quote, give the false impression that sex is something shameful or dirty, because it is a great gift of God who placed the ability to generate life in the human body, thereby sharing his creative power with us. So sex is a good thing. Sex is a powerful thing. But because it is so powerful, it's something that can even create a new human being, someone with a new immortal soul. it has to be used properly. To misuse it can be a very grave and serious sin. So paragraph 2349 of the Catechism says that married people are called to live conjugal chastity. Others practice chastity in continence. Continence means you don't have sex. Now, it's very common for people to confuse celibacy and continence, as well as incontinent. Incontinent means you can't go to the bathroom. Continence means you don't have sex. Celibacy means you're not married. So there can be cases where you're married, but you practice continence. You are not having sex. Maybe your wife just had a baby, so you refrain from having sex so she can heal from childbirth for, 4 to 6 weeks or however long it takes. So what the Catechism says is that married people are called to live conjugal chastity. Unmarried people must practice continence. Married people practice conjugal chastity. But what is conjugal chastity? You won't find a succinct definition of it in the Catechism or other church documents. But what you do find when you read moral theologians, when you read the writings of people who study Catholic morality, is essentially that conjugal chastity refers to ordering the sexual act towards its proper ends, the unitive and procreative ends, and to not split it away from either of those two things. So that sex is for the expression of married love for two people to become one flesh. So for uniting the spouses and always making sure that they are open to life. Greg Popchek is a Catholic therapist who wrote a great book called Holy Sex. I definitely recommend it for this topic. And in the book, he talks about the pleasure principles. He talks about principles for married Catholic couples to have pleasurable, loving sexual unions, but to do so in a holy way. And basically, he boils it down to one principle supersedes all the others. He says, every act of lovemaking must be respectful of the dignity of the couple and must express both an intention for greater unity and openness to life. And he goes on to say, in other words, sexual behavior with husband and wife, no matter how it starts, what it must end with the husband ejaculating into the woman's vagina. So when the husband reaches sexual climax, what must occur from there is that the sperm is deposited in the woman's vagina. And so why is that? Some people think, well, this is just mechanics. It's just plumbing. Why do you make things so physicalist, biological essentialism, things like that? It's not just that. What sex is for two people to become one flesh, for a husband and wife to form a true union. But in order to have a true union, you can't just stick one body part inside of another. When a dentist puts his fingers in my mouth to see if I have any cavities, or a surgeon puts his hand into my abdomen, the two have not become one flesh. To form a union, two separate parts must come together to form a whole that is greater than themselves. So for example, if I receive a kidney or a heart transplant, I and the organ I receive, we become one. We form a true union because we're united to a good beyond ourselves, namely keeping me alive. So a husband and wife, in order to form a true sexual union, they have to form a union that's open to life. It's open to this goal beyond themselves. And so what that has to end with is ends in vaginal intercourse, where ejaculation occurs in the vagina. So just to be frank and honest, that is kind of our guiding principle for understanding which sexual acts are okay and which are not okay. However, when we go back to Pope St. John Paul II, writing before he was pope in his book, Love and Responsibility, he says this great point on page 275. He says, marriage cannot be reduced to the physical relationship. It needs an emotional climate without which the virtues, whether that of love or that of chastity, become difficult to realize and practice. So as we go on and talk about what is okay and not okay with our sexuality, this is just not about, well, make sure rod A is inserted into slot B. It's not just about biological maneuvering. It's about persons fully receiving one another as a gift of themselves. That's one of the great benefits of Pope St. John Paul II's theology of the body, that sexual union is for the free, totally free, faithful, and complete gift of self between spouses, that they hold nothing back to give themselves to one another to become one flesh. And that includes not just a biological giving, but an emotional and spiritual giving and a tender and compassionate care towards one another, so that sex is not just something we use to feel good, it becomes a genuine expression of this unique and awe-inspiring love that we call marital love that makes people become one flesh, open towards the creation of new human life. So that's kind of our framework to understand that what sex is for, both the broad view and also to understand that specific acts must end with vaginal intercourse and ejaculation in the vagina. Here's the next question. When I started dating, I struggled with what was acceptable in terms of a physical and intimate relationship before marriage. Knowing I wanted to abstain until marriage, I never had sexual intercourse, but was sexually intimate in other ways with my husband before we were married, justifying it in that, well, we weren't having sex. Are those means of intimacy, oral sex, hand jobs, ever acceptable before or even after marriage? A similar question comes from another person. They ask, for married couples past childbearing years, women in menopause, is oral sex sinful? So let's go back to our main principle. What is sex for? Sex is for the expression of marital love. What marital love seeks is the total one flesh union between husband and wife, a real union, and that union can only exist through vaginal intercourse. But that doesn't mean that a husband and wife, in engaging in the marital act, only engage in vaginal intercourse to say, well, you can't touch each other, you can't kiss, just engage in the vaginal intercourse, don't like it, and that's the end of it. That's not the case at all. That there's other, of course, other sexual behaviors that lead up to vaginal intercourse that are acceptable within the context of the marital act for married couples. So when it comes to unmarried couples, you know, this questioner said, we were doing these things before we were married. Were they okay? And the answer is absolutely not. The Catechism says in paragraph 2352, and this is quoting the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, their document Persona Humana, paragraph 2352 of the Catechism says, the deliberate use of the sexual faculty, for whatever reason, outside of marriage, is essentially contrary to its purpose. For here, sexual pleasure is sought outside of the sexual relationship, which is demanded by the moral order, and in which the total meaning of mutual self-giving and human procreation in the context of true love is achieved. So to answer the question, things like oral stimulation, manual stimulation of the genitals with the hands, that is never acceptable outside of marriage. Notice here I did not use the phrase oral sex. What sex is, it is the union of a husband and wife that is achieved in the marital act, specifically through vaginal intercourse. That's what sex is. That's what the sexual act is. So it's a misnomer to say there could be something like oral sex or anal sex or things like that. There's certainly sexual stimulation that can occur manually, you know, with the hands or orally with the mouth and the tongue, but they are not sexual acts in and of themselves. They can never be done outside of the context of marriage. Now, in the context of marriage, of course, husbands and wives can stimulate one another so as to prepare their bodies for vaginal intercourse. That's a normal, healthy way to engage in sexual relations. So in marriage, these means of stimulation, whether it's caressing the body with the hands, kissing the body, using the mouth to stimulate the body in various ways, those are acceptable provided that they ultimately lead to vaginal intercourse and that ejaculation occurs with the penis inside of the vagina. Now, could there be premature ejaculation that occurs unintentionally? That may be the case. That is not sinful if it occurs accidentally or unintentionally. It does become a sin if it occurs intentionally outside of the woman's body. And in fact, in Genesis chapter 38, the Bible records one instance of contraception using this method, coitus interruptus, where Onan, he didn't want to carry on his brother's name, so he engages in sex, and it says he spilled his seed on the ground. He ejaculated outside of his wife's body. This displeased God so much that God struck him down. Now, I'm not saying God's going to do that to everybody who engages in coitus interruptus today, but it does show that sex is sacred and that to misuse our sexuality, to order it away from the unitive and procreative purposes of which it was meant, leads to grave sexual sin that we engage in at our own peril and we should not do under any circumstances. So I want to touch on the second question here. This person asked, for married couples past childbearing years, woman in menopause, is oral sex sinful? So what have we been saying? It does become sinful if it's used as a means for the man to ejaculate in the woman's mouth to try to become a replacement for the sexual act. So if he's asking this because vaginal intercourse is painful for someone post-menopause, then that would be sinful, that would be wrong. However, if he's concerned that they cannot become pregnant if we are using oral stimulation that then leads to vaginal intercourse, and you're concerned, well, my wife is past menopause, she can't get pregnant, would this be wrong? The answer is no, of course not. You're still engaging in the marital act. We cannot control whether we become pregnant or not through vaginal intercourse. That's something beyond our control. God is the one who blesses us with children. So just because someone has become infertile, it doesn't mean sex with them is wrong. You can still engage in the marital act if you're validly married. What you cannot do is replace the sexual act with stimulation that leads to ejaculation outside of vaginal intercourse. And just as an aside, I was at a book study several months ago. A group of moms were studying my book, Why We're Catholic, and they asked me to come in and do an open Q&A session with them about what I thought would be about the book. But the very first question from one of the moms was this. It was a younger mom, more around my age, but she said, look, I just have to ask, is oral sex with your husband? I mean, a friend of mine's asking this question. Is oral sex with your husband, is that wrong? And I said, keeping a straight face in front of all these moms, it's okay as an on-ramp to sexual intimacy. It's not okay as an off-ramp. It can't be used as a means in and of itself for pleasure or to reach the end or ejaculation intentionally, but it can be used as an on-ramp to achieve stimulation to prepare the bodies for vaginal intercourse. All right, here's the next question. Is it wrong for a female to finish outside of the actual act? To put it bluntly, either before or after my wife and I have penetrative sex, I will help her to orgasm herself using manual, oral, or artificial stimulation. I'm very conflicted as to whether these are unnatural, lustful acts or a loving way to help my wife fully experience lovemaking and be a gift to her. And I think the questioner here is on the right track when he talks about being a gift to his spouse and to fully experience lovemaking. Because, of course, what is sex for? The expression of marital love. The expression of the full, free, faithful, and total gift of self between the spouses. And one of those gifts that we offer to one another is the gift of sexual pleasure. That sex is ordered towards the unitive and procreative ends to unite the spouses and to be open to life, but that doesn't mean that pleasure isn't one of the ends of sex, or that we should avoid pleasure, or that pleasure is a bad thing. Sex only becomes disordered when we seek the pleasure in and of itself and reject those other important ends. A good analogy I can make would be eating. So we should eat. Eating is natural. There's nothing wrong with eating food that tastes good or cooking food so that it tastes very good. But there is something wrong when we eat food only because we want to taste how good it is and then we vomit it up later. So when we do that, we pervert the natural end of eating and seek the pleasure alone. And that's the same thing that happens with our sexuality when couples use contraceptives, for example. They're seeking the pleasure and emotional comfort that comes from sexual intimacy, but they're vomiting up essentially this other important natural good, such as being open to life, or, you know, using pornography or masturbation. You're definitely just seeking the pleasure alone, apart from either the procreative purposes or the unitive purposes of sexuality. So husbands and wives can share in the pleasure of sexual intercourse together. And in order to do that, we have to understand that husbands and wives, men and women, are different. And we have to understand those differences if husbands and wives are going to naturally and morally share in pleasure with one another. And a good resource to go to this, I would recommend, would be Pope St. John Paul II's work, Love and Responsibility, that was he published in Poland in 1960. This is, of course, before he became Pope. And he wrote a great book. Essentially, it's on the philosophy of sexuality. It's his personalist philosophy being applied to love, marriage, and the good of our sexuality. Here's a few excerpts that I think will be helpful for us to answer this question. The excerpts I'll read to you come between pages 272 and 274. They're actually in the chapter on sexology and ethics. So here is what he says. If a woman does not obtain natural gratification from the sexual act, there is a danger that her experience of it will be qualitatively inferior, will not involve her fully as a person. So sex is the full gift between persons, and that if the husband is not sensitive to the physical needs of his wife, that will differ from his own because her anatomy is very different than his, then the Pope says, and I know that he was Caro Wotia when he wrote this, but for simplicity, I'm just going to say Pope St. John Paul II. Then the Pope says her experience of it will be qualitatively inferior. She won't feel involved fully as a person. He goes on to say, the natural kindness of a woman who, so the sexologists tell us, sometimes shams orgasm to satisfy a man's pride, or fakes her orgasms, may also be unhelpful in the long run. There is here a real need for sexual education, and it must be a continuous process. The main objective of this education is to create the conviction that the other person is more important than I. So the Pope is saying that to fully love one another, for spouses to fully love one another within the sexual act, there is a need for education about the sexual act, that we shouldn't just read dry theology. We have to understand, well, what is sex? What are the biological characteristics, the anatomical characteristics of vaginal intercourse and other sexual aspects of men and women? What are these things? And how are they pleasurable? How do we reach their proper ends with them? And the more we understand the human body and how it works, the more we will be able to fully love one another. And that should be the goal of this education, is to fully know the other, to fully love the other, and fully treat the other as being more important than I. He goes on to say, non-observance of these teachings of sexology in the marital relationship is contrary to the good of the other partner to the marriage and the durability and cohesion of the marriage itself. So we should be aware of these teachings about the human body. Finally, he says, sexologists state that the curve of arousal in women is different from that in man. It rises more slowly and falls more slowly. The man must take this difference between male and female reactions into account, not for hedonistic, but for altruistic reasons. There exists a rhythm dictated by nature itself, which both spouses must discover so that climax may be reached both by the man and by the woman, and, here's the important part, as far as possible, occur in both simultaneously. So when a man and woman understand their bodies, understand how they can both feel pleasurable responses with different sexual positions, different things like that, different acts of stimulation, that as far as possible, it's great that in order to have this union, if they can both achieve orgasm at the same time, that would be wonderful. But as the Pope says, sexologists have shown us, and I know that's kind of an anachronistic term, but we would say sexual experts, experts in human anatomy, what they show us is that sexual arousal and completion is different in men and women. So it may be the case that the man is able to reach climax and ejaculate in the woman's vagina through certain stimulation that will not cause the woman to reach orgasm. In fact, statistically speaking, most women cannot reach orgasm through vaginal intercourse alone. So as long as it is a part of that act, whether shortly before or after, if it is part of the act, whether it's before the final chapter of the book or it's in the epilogue in the book, you know, it's the chapter right after the last chapter, then it is acceptable for the man to stimulate the wife or for the wife to stimulate herself to reach orgasm and to have that sexual pleasure that they both want to give to one another as being full gifts of themselves. So yes, it is acceptable as part of the marital act, as part of vaginal intercourse, to use manual, oral, or artificial stimulation. And I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but if it means putting on something like a vibrator tool on a person's finger so that they're able to more deeply stimulate their wife to help her to reach orgasm, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, as long as it's done as part of the marital act itself. Now, if the husband and wife, if the wife manually stimulates her husband to reach climax at some point during the day, or the man stimulates the wife to reach climax, and this is done outside of the marital act, then that would be wrong. That would be masturbation or mutual masturbation. What keeps these sexual behaviors from being mutually masturbatory would, of course, be leading into that one flesh union or vaginal intercourse where the man deposits his sperm in the woman's vagina. But as I said before, stimulation leading up to that is perfectly acceptable. Bringing the woman to completion before the man reaches completion in her vagina is acceptable. Or bringing the woman to completion after the man deposits sperm in the vagina is acceptable if it is part of that one marital act that they are engaged in. And it's important for him to do this, not just that it's acceptable, but it's preferable, as Pope St. John Paul II says, so that the woman feels that she is fully involved in the act and that she can receive the pleasure from it that God created for both men and women to be able to enjoy in one another, because sex is a good thing. That's why it's pleasurable. God wants us to have it, and he wants us to be fruitful and multiply. So as a matter of justice between the spouses, men and women should offer themselves to one another and be able to bring one another to completion in moral ways. Here's the next question. What are church teachings on fetishes and different positions? I've heard what is referenced as doggy style is wrong. Once again, I'm going to keep doing this because I want you to do this when you grapple with sexual questions about whether this is right or wrong. Go back to our big principles. First, sexual behavior is moral. It's ordered towards unitive and procreative ends. So a man's ejaculation or orgasm is only acceptable through vaginal intercourse where he deposits his sperm into the vagina. And sex as a whole is not meant for merely extracting pleasure from another person. We should not use persons as means to extract sexual pleasure. Sex is for husbands and wives being total, free, faithful, and total gifts of selves to the other person, to fully give themselves to the other person in intimate marital love. And that is a good thing. That is a pleasurable thing. And so when we remember that, we can avoid two extremes when questions like these are asked. And those extremes are Puritanism, that tries to minimize sexual pleasure as much as possible and sees it as a bad thing, and Hedonism, which tries to maximize sexual pleasure as much as possible and sees it as the only thing or the most important thing. The middle ground is to see that sexual pleasure is a end in sexuality. It is a good thing. It is not the primary end. It is not the biggest thing we are aiming for, but it is a good thing in sexual union that husbands and wives should be able to celebrate in with one another. So when it comes to different sexual positions, as long as they respect the dignity of the spouse, that you're not causing violence or injury towards that person, there's no sexual position that would be intrinsically wrong for the husband and wife to come together, provided that they are engaging in vaginal intercourse towards its proper end. You don't have to just engage in the missionary position or the man on top position. The term missionary position, to refer to the position of the woman lying on her back and the man being on top, comes from Alfred Kinsey, a very frankly messed up person. You can read about him online, a sexologist in the middle of the 20th century. He'd be the bad sexologist Pope St. John Paul II would say stay away from. But he coined the term missionary position. And there's the urban legend that natives and other tribes, you know, they would have practiced positions more what's called rear entry or doggy style. The woman is on all fours and the man enters the vagina sitting or kneeling from behind. That the missionary said, no, no, God only wants you to be man on top, woman lying on her back, and said this is the only thing that's allowed. That's a misnomer. What we call the missionary position can be found in pottery, in cave drawings, in literature, in all different kinds of ancient civilizations and modern civilizations. And the Catholic Church has never said that this is the only position one should engage in. There are certain merits to the missionary position. The fact that it's face-to-face engages greater comfort and emotional intimacy, for example, but the church has never said that this is the only position one can engage in the marital act. And it's gone by different names throughout history. If you know Shakespeare, in the play Othello, in Act 1, Scene 1, one of the characters says, I have to inform you, your daughter and the Moor being a term for a Muslim inhabitant of Spain, they have formed the beast with two backs. So that was a euphemistic reference in Shakespeare, actually, to the missionary position. And so there's no one single position that someone has to engage in. Once again, as long as it doesn't cause violence or injury to your spouse and it respects them, the dignity of their person, there's no position, provided it leads to ejaculation, vaginal intercourse, that in and of itself would be wrong. The questioner also asked, what about fetishes? And went on to ask, ultimately, how and where do we draw the line between keeping sex sacred and respectful and the way God intended, while also attempting to maintain variety and allurement? Is it all right to even be concerned about variety? What's a good rule of thumb when determining what is right and what is wrong? So I think the rule of thumb should be this. Are we using sex as a way to fully give ourselves to our spouse, to delight in the sacrament of marriage that God has given us, to fully become a gift that's open to life to one another, and the pleasure that comes from that is something that we enjoy? Are we doing that? Or are we just using sex as a means so that we can get the greatest amount of pleasure, the most powerful orgasms we can? That if we're doing the latter, we're corrupting what sex is for. And I think a lot of fetishes or sexual attractions that people have, they fall into that latter category, and that's what we should be afraid of. So what is okay in sexual behavior and different sexual preferences to create that environment so that sexual pleasure is heightened? What is okay and what's not okay? Well, obviously, if we make a spectrum, there's going to be things that are definitely okay and things that are definitely not okay. So, you know, things are definitely okay, you know, tasteful lingerie, candles, setting a mood and environment, and ideally to have a pleasurable experience between spouses. Foreplay would begin earlier in the day with the husband being attentive to his wife's needs, showing emotional connection, to build up that emotional connection, that spiritual connection, before physical connection is made in the marital act. Now, what kind of sexual preferences, behaviors, fetish is the word that's sometimes used, would definitely be wrong. I would say things that are offenses to the norms of marriage themselves, to fidelity, being open to life. So things like group sex or sexual activity outside of the marital act, things like voyeurism, wanting to see other people engaging in sex, exhibitionism, having sex so that other people can see you and being aroused at the thought of someone seeing you having sex. So any sexual attraction that we have that contradicts the norms of marriage or what it's for and leads to grave sin, those are things that we should not engage in. Another fetish that I would say is definitely wrong are sexual behaviors that are a simulation of evil. That if we're using sexual fantasy or sexual behavior to simulate evil, then we ought not do that. We should flee from evil. We should reject it. We should never glorify it in any way to say, well, we're not really doing this. We're just pretending. That's not something we should ever do, especially with something as sacred as our sexuality. So I would say sexual behaviors that include things like rape fantasies, adultery fantasies, incest fantasies, sex outside of the marriage bond, that when someone is using fantasy and sexual behavior to try to safely engage in evil through a kind of technicality by saying, well, we're just pretending, it's just role-playing. No, I would say that's wrong. That's falling into the area of lust, the inordinate pursuit of sexual pleasure, and in many cases, these cases, disordered sexual pleasure, not love or the true gift of self. Even things that can seem innocent, like a spouse bringing out their Catholic schoolgirl uniform. Maybe they went to a Catholic school and living out the fantasy of being teenagers engaging in fornication. Here, what's happening? We're simulating evil, or wearing a costume, you know, the sexy maid outfit or something like that. You might think, well, it's spicing up my marriage and that's helpful. My husband's excited. Yeah, but what happens when he sees a regular maid? Or he sees, you know, a regular librarian or someone that we've fetishized and turned into a sexual object. That's also why husbands and wives should not watch pornography together in the marital bed to stimulate them or prepare them for sexual union. Because what it does is it primes them to think that sex is about mining pleasure from one another instead of being a gift of self to one another to cherish the other person as a person. So yeah, of course, there's going to be things here in the middle between the extremes of things that are definitely okay and things that are definitely not okay. So what should you do? Well, I would say listen to your conscience and pray. Don't just do whatever you think is okay. Pray and form your conscience. Go to confession. Seek out spiritual direction. You might think, well, what does a priest know about this stuff? He's just some celibate man. Well, look, Pope St. John Paul II was celibate when he wrote Love and Responsibility, and he hits the nail on the head throughout that book about how husbands should love their wives as Christ loved the church, how husbands should love their wives and bring them to the fullness of sexual love and sexual pleasure. So finding a good spiritual director or a Catholic counselor, I think, would be very, very helpful so you know that you're truly loving one another, you're truly communicating to one another, and achieving the proper ends of marriage. And one way to do that is to pray every day, to offer up your marriage to God, and especially to pray before you engage in sexual intimacy. Even if it's brief in the heat of the moment, to take a moment to say, God, we want to offer up our bodies to you, our marriage to you, this sexual union. Please bless it. Bless any child that may come from it. And we want to glorify you, and we thank you for the gift you've given each of us. And a great prayer that you can always remember and read, something you could even read together before engaging in sexual intimacy, comes from the book of Tobit, in Tobit chapter 8, verses 4 through 8. Here's what it says. When the door was shut and the two were alone, this is talking about Tobias and Sarah shortly after they were married. When the door was shut and the two were alone, Tobias got up from the bed and said, "Sister, get up and let us pray that the Lord may have mercy upon us." And Tobias began to pray, "Blessed art thou, O God of our fathers, and blessed be thy holy and glorious name forever. Let the heavens and all thy creatures bless thee. Thou madest Adam and gavest him Eve, his wife, as a helper and support. From them the race of mankind has sprung. Thou didst say, it is not good that the man should be alone. Let us make a helper for him like himself. And now, O Lord, I am not taking this sister of mine because of lust, but with sincerity. Grant that I may find mercy and may grow old together with her." And she said with him, "Amen." And so I hope that you will be able to pray together. If you are married, you'll be able to pray together with your spouse before intimacy and say that sweet, beautiful amen together as well. That if you're a single person, I pray for you as you discern your vocation, whether it's to the religious life, priesthood, whatever it may be, that you'll be able to find joy in your sexuality and know that you were created to be a sexual being, not to repress your sexual feelings, but to express your identity as a man or a woman, created in the image and likeness of God, and to carry yourself with modesty and dignity, and to speak the truth of God's plan for sexuality for all of us to a culture that is blind to it, but if they heard it, would find great joy in it. And so I hope you'll share that with others and to share this podcast with other people who would benefit. Maybe you know a married couple who would benefit from this, or another mature audience who would benefit from hearing about these questions. Some great resources I'd recommend if you want to learn more about this topic. I really like the book Holy Sex by Greg Popcheck. Ed Sree has a wonderful book, Men, Women, and the Mystery of Love. And an oldie, it's a bit higher level, but I think you'd really appreciate it, is Love and Responsibility by Pope St. John Paul II, written when he was Carol Wojtyła. And definitely recommend this podcast to other people. If you want to get access to premium content where I'll go deeper into these and other subjects, visit TrentHornPodcast.com. And don't forget to leave a review at iTunes, Google Play, and anywhere else where this podcast can be downloaded. Thank you guys so much, and I will pray for you, and please continue to pray for me.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.